Fed is the main Rothbard article that I put on the reading list. And at the beginning of this article, Rothbard talks a lot about the myth of the independent Fed, which is why I put one of my old articles on the same topic in there. And also in that article, he talks about the origins of the Fed, the creation of the Fed, and how the big money men on Wall Street, the Morgans, Rockefellers, the Loebs, and other big investment bankers of the early 20th century recruited academics to tell tall tales about the alleged need for a government institution that would cartelize the banking industry. And this, so there's a long history of this, of economists performing the role of court historians, if you will. And I picked out two good examples of this in terms of the most popular textbook in the world, economics textbook in the world, from the 1948 until about the early to mid-1980s, with Paul Samuelson's Principles of Economics book. And here's what he said. Here's what generations of students all over the world were taught about the Fed's objectives. He said this. This is from the 1989 edition. The Federal Reserve's goals are steady growth in national output and low unemployment. Its sworn enemy is inflation. If aggregate demand is excessive so that prices are being bid up, the Federal Reserve Board may want to slow the growth of the money supply, thereby slowing aggregate demand and output growth. If unemployment is high and business languishing, the Fed may consider increasing the money supply, thereby raising aggregate demand and augmenting output growth. In a nutshell, this is the function of central banking, which is an essential part of macroeconomic management in all mixed economies. So the students are taught that the Fed is an apolitical automaton that faithfully pursues the public interest by cooling down the economy when there's too much inflation and stimulating the economy when there's not enough economic growth, all in the public interest. The second biggest selling book during this era was an equally horrible book by Campbell McConnell called Economics. And he says this, because it is a public body, it is government, the decisions of the Board of Governors are made in what it perceives to be the public interest. No self-interest there. So that's me saying that. To continue with the quote, the Federal Reserve banks are not guided by the profit motive, but rather they pursue those measures which the Board of Governors recommends. The fundamental objective of monetary policy is to assist the economy in achieving the full employment, non-inflationary level of total output. So this is the government as a group of angels theory that was taught to generations of students from the 1940s on, and still is to this day. And it's hard to believe that anyone above an infant would believe such a thing, but repetition after repetition can be very persuasive. And so students who are taught this in every class they take at the university level in economics, well, a lot of them come to believe it. But the reality, of course, is very different than this, than what the court historians say in the textbook. The reality is that the Fed has always been a political animal. For a government institution whose chairman is appointed by the president and who has to go through Senate confirmation hearing, for that institution to be apolitical or not a part of politics is as likely as a dog who meows like a cat, or a cat that barks like a dog, or a unicorn for that matter. There's just ain't no such thing. For example, Franklin Roosevelt appointed a man named Mariner Eccles to be the head of the Fed. Now, who was Mariner Eccles? Well, he was a political hanger-on. He was a strong supporter of deficit spending and inflationary finance. He didn't even have an undergraduate degree, but he was a political accomplice of Franklin Roosevelt. And so he was the perfect appointee to the Fed. He was a person who really had no talent, no ability to manage the money supply, and therefore he had to rely on orders that were given to him by Franklin Roosevelt and his advisors. And so the president himself, in effect, ran the Fed by virtue of having appointed Mariner Eccles. And at the same time, Paul Samuelson is out there writing books, as were others, saying that this is an apolitical institution, has nothing to do with politics. There was an economic researcher named Robert Weintraub, who passed away many years ago, but he wrote some really good research articles in monetary economics in the 1970s and 80s. And one of them was a survey of how monetary policy changed directions abruptly right after presidential elections in the United States. And the idea here is that Fed chairmen understand if they want to be reappointed, they'd better pay attention to what the president is saying with regard to his preferences, faster monetary growth, slower monetary growth, whatever, if he wants to be reappointed. And for example, President Eisenhower made it known that he wanted slower monetary growth because of the fear of inflation. So the money supply grew by 1.73% during his administration, which was the slowest rate in a decade. Then when President Kennedy came in 1961, he publicly expressed a desire for faster monetary growth. So from January 1961 to November 1963, the money supply grew by 2.31%. Lyndon Johnson wanted even more rapid growth to help finance the Vietnam War and an expansion of the welfare state. So the money supply growth more than doubled to about 5% during the Johnson administration. And all of these different rates of monetary growth all occurred under the same Fed chairman, William McChesney Martin, who obviously was not guided by some consistent theory of what the Fed should be doing to maintain price stability. He was guided by the theory of, if I want to keep my job and be reappointed, I'll pay close attention to what the president wants and do what he wants, so that the politicians, after all, do control the Fed. And the idea that the Fed is independent of politics really is nonsense. So now Arthur Burns, who was the Fed chairman under Richard Nixon, really lost all professional credibility when his staff informed him in fall of 72, which was an election year, that the money supply was forecast to grow at 10.5% in the third quarter, which was already inflationary. But Burns made sure that the money supply grew even faster during the quarter before the election. And the growth rate of the money supply in 1972 was the fastest for any one year since the end of World War II, and Richard Nixon got elected. And of course, it created price inflation. And so when Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford, came in, he made it known that he wanted slower growth. And so the Fed complied. He got 4.7% growth rate of the money supply. And then when President Carter did not reappoint Arthur Burns, but Carter wanted faster growth too, and the money supply increased at an annual rate of 16.2% in the 5 months preceding the 1980 election. So Carter had saw to it that the Fed would do for him, hopefully, pump up the money supply right before the election, what Nixon did to get himself reelected. It worked for Nixon, but it did not work for Carter. Then in 1981, Donald Regan, who was President Reagan's Treasury Secretary, loudly advocated more rapid monetary growth, and he got it. Okay, and then Paul Volcker came in as Fed chairman, and President Reagan urged him to slow down monetary growth, which he did. And so the Fed has always been used as a political tool. There was an economist named Edward Kane who has an interesting theory that the Fed is often used as sort of a political football, as they say in Washington, whereby if the economy is doing well, then they will hold hearings and all the members of Congress will congratulate the Fed chairman. They will work with the media to have the media write stories about the Fed chairman as the maestro of the economy. And they, of course, will take some of the credit, and especially the president who appointed him or who reappointed him, will take the credit for the good economy. If at the same time, if the economy is bad, they will bring the same person in front of them at hearings and lambast him and criticize him and make him take the blame. And so that's the purpose of the Fed. Take the blame for when things go bad and then allow the politicians to surround themselves around the Fed chairman when things are going well so that they can take some of the credit for things going well, even if they have nothing whatsoever to do with it. Okay. And also, personal contact or meetings between the president and the Fed chairman are not really necessary. The way the communication works is the presidents will send their spokesman, the Treasury Secretary, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, people like that, to make public speeches announcing the administration's desires with regard to monetary policy. And of course, the Fed chairman and the Board of Governors will be listening to that. So they don't need to actually meet even. There's another economist named Thomas Haverleski, who is a pretty well-known monetary economist, who published several articles and developed an index of executive branch signaling based on newspaper accounts of the administration's preferences expressed in the Wall Street Journal. And so there's actually academic research that documents that this is how the game is played. And of course, there's a demand for inflation. There are many constituencies for inflation in addition to the banks who want to be able to lend more money and be bailed out for their bad loans by the Fed. You've got the whole home building industry, the construction unions, financial institutions of all sorts that earn their living by lending money for housing construction. So you've got a big demand by all sorts of special interest groups for inflation of the money supply, and the government responds. The Fed also is involved in all sorts of research and publication, much of which is very political, very political. Some of the most egregious examples I can think of are some truly bogus studies of lending discrimination that were used to justify the enforcement of something called the Community Reinvestment Act by the Fed. This is a law in the U.S. that's been around since 1977, and it basically forces mortgage lenders to make bad loans by the trillions over the years to unqualified borrowers. And the excuse was, original excuse was, banks were not lending enough money to minority borrowers because of racism. And so and the ridiculous thing about this is that the Fed even claimed that minority-owned banks were even guilty of racism. And that on its face should cause anyone to smell a rat about this claim. But the Fed, in 1992, for example, the Boston Fed published a big report that was widely distributed and touted by all the other Fed banks, claiming that there was persistent mortgage loan discrimination against minorities. And the study, however, wanted to justify quotas in lending quotas by banks, forced on them by the government, by the Fed in particular, the report failed to control for creditworthiness, such as credit rating, job history, income, and so forth. It just looked at the distribution of loans by race, and it didn't control for creditworthiness. And when Alicia Monell, who was the Fed president of the Boston Fed at the time, was asked by two Forbes magazine reporters, Peter Grimelow and Leslie Spencer, what evidence do you have of actual discrimination? She said this, and here's a direct quote, "I do not have evidence. No one has evidence of lending bias." But that's okay. They don't need evidence. And the report just claimed that it existed, and that was supposedly to be enough to justify forcing mortgage lenders to make bad loans to unqualified borrowers. Those were called subprime loans. And the Fed actually gave Countrywide Bank in America, I think I mentioned this last week maybe, an award for having made $600 billion in these bad loans. And this was a couple of weeks before Countrywide Bank went bankrupt a couple of years ago. The Fed also does a lot of lobbying, not the Fed itself, but the banking industry. there's a lot of lobbying for the Fed. And so as a political animal, the dispenses all these political favors. In return for this, the people who work for the Fed do live high on the hog. That's the payback for all the things that they do to finance the welfare warfare state in America. About 20-some years ago, roughly 20 years ago, there was a member of Congress named Gonzalez who actually got the General Accounting Office to do a mini survey or audit of the Fed. It wasn't a very comprehensive audit, it was a very minor audit. And they just, for the one of the first times ever, got a peek at some of the expenditures of the Fed. And here's some of the things they found. The Fed spent, this is back in 1996, the Fed spent over $2 billion on itself. The Fed has had 25,000 employees, has its own air force of 47 Learjets and small cargo planes. It also has fleets of company cars, so-called, including personal cars for 59 Fed bank managers. It has a full-time paid curator to oversee its collection of paintings and sculptures in its buildings. The Fed at that time had $451 billion in accumulated assets. And today, of course, the assets of the Fed are many orders of magnitude larger than that. And at the time, it was building for itself several extensive new office buildings. The number of Fed employees in 1996 earning more than $125,000 a year doubled from 1993 to 1996. And even the head janitor, whose job title is Support Services Director, was paid $163,800 in annual salary. That's a pretty good salary for a janitor, plus benefits. And so, and also money was spent lavishly on country club memberships, entertainment, travel, and so forth. And so there's a payoff to the Fed bureaucrats in being the instrument that finances the welfare, warfare, police state in America. And this is just one glimpse that Americans have had of the perks that the Fed spends on itself. There's an economist named Mark Toma, T-O-M-A. I think there's another one with the same name, but it's called T-H-O-M-A. But the good Mark Toma is T-O-M-A. And he was actually a fellow graduate student of mine way back when the dinosaurs still roamed the earth at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. He's published a number of articles about how the Fed employees benefit from inflation, as have other economists, William Shugart and Robert Tollison, have published a number of articles in the American Economic Review, of all places, about how the Fed has an incentive to inflate. Because the Fed uses, when the Fed engages in expansionary monetary policy, increases the money supply through open market purchases. It purchases bonds, and it earns interest on these bonds, and it gets to keep some of that interest income that it earns on these bonds. And so it has a built-in incentive of personal self-interest to inflate, to put more money in circulation by buying bonds. Shugart, Tollison, and Toma have argued in peer-reviewed academic journal publications. And so, again, the idea that they are selfless and in pursuit of the public interest and not self-interest is nonsense. Everyone pursues their self-interest, politicians as well as people in the private sector. And so the Fed is certainly always has been a political animal, contrary to what students are still taught, still told. And I think at this point it's worth retelling the Fed cartel story to understand why it is that the Fed was created. It's, Rothbard gives chapter and verse of the role of some of the big money people on Wall Street and why they wanted a central bank. But with commodity money, to recap this, I talked about this last week, with commodity money like gold and silver, in a competing or competitive banking system, if any one bank inflated its currency and the others didn't, then the people would soon catch on that the currency produced by that bank was worth less and less, and they would not want to do business with that bank. There would be a run on the bank. People would want to redeem their currency for gold or silver, and it would go bankrupt. Okay, that's one of the things that controlled to a very large degree. Inflation under a gold standard or any kind of commodity standard. And so with the creation of central banking in general, not just the Fed, but central banking anywhere, the dilemma was bankers wanted to be able to lend out more money. That's how they make money, charging interest on loans. Then they were able to if they kept a high proportion of reserves, that is gold and silver in reserve. They always wanted to lend out more than was safe. But they ran into this dilemma that they would devalue their own currency by doing that. But if they could all increase their currency in circulation at the same time, then no one or no few banks would be at a competitive disadvantage with that situation where their currency is being devalued and no one else is. And at the same time, they would want to be bailed out if they all failed. And that's why the Fed is called the lender of last resort. It bails out the commercial banks when they overextend themselves and make too many bad loans. And that's why also, by the way, the government created in the U.S. These so-called government-sponsored enterprises, which are known as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were capitalized in the trillions of dollars to buy up bad loans, which they had done. And then they had to be bailed out by the taxpayers and by the Fed in the past 5 years. And so keep in mind, that's the sort of the cartel story. The Fed and all central banks really are the enforcement mechanisms of a cartel that eliminates competition in the banking industry in a way that allows the banking industry to inflate the currency. And so forget about all the statements that the Fed makes and other central banks make about their sacred duty being to control inflation. Their very reason for existence is to create inflation. That's why they were created. If you read the Rothbard's account of the creation of the Fed, the proponents argued that we need more money in circulation. That was always the argument. It wasn't that we needed to control the money supply and stop inflation. It was that we needed more inflation. That's why to this day, the most monetary economists will say, it is desirable to have some degree of inflation. That's Ben Bernanke's position. You know, 3%, 4%, something like that is good because deflation is always and everywhere bad in their book. God forbid that I would have to pay less for my next new car or anything, or a pair of pants for that matter. And the mainstream economists also talk about an optimal quantity of money. These are the defenders of central banking, optimal quantity of money, which is never the existing quantity of money under a commodity standard. There's always supposedly a need for more money in circulation. But I think it's important to understand that money is simply a mechanism for exchange. And once the whole world adopted gold and silver, primarily gold, as the monetary standard, there's really no need for more money. Money changes hands. There's a velocity of money that we talk about in economics. There's no inherent need for the money supply to grow commensurately with the rest of the economy. In fact, whenever the money supply does grow faster than the production of goods grows, it creates price inflation. And price inflation devalues the value of all privately held wealth. It makes economic calculation more difficult. It creates boom and bust cycles in the economy. And there's nothing wrong with the idea that the production of goods and services will outstrip the amount of money in circulation, because if that happens, we have lower prices. We have deflation. In the United States, we had the whole period after the American Civil War in 1865 to the turn of the century was a period of deflation. Price deflation, because it was what historians call the second industrial revolution. There was rapid production of goods and services that drove down prices. There was a creation of many new products that never existed before, and there was a lot of competition that drove down prices. That was all good. That was a good deflation. You can talk about a bad deflation that happens because the economy is wrecked, either the bust cycle, the boom and bust cycle caused by central banking, That's the bad deflation because it's based on lower demand. Consumers don't have any money because they haven't been producing anything. But the good deflation is caused by production. And so increasing in the money supply only does one thing, it creates inflation, price inflation, and it creates boom and bust cycles in the economy, and it's all bad. It's good for the bankers because the central bank allows them to lend more money and make more profit than they ever could in any other way, and the central bank bails them out when they fail. And the first big bailout of the last several decades, by the way, was the federal government's bailout in the U.S. of the savings and loan banks. There was a savings and loan crisis in the 1980s, and the government bailed them out to the tune of $500 million. That's, hardly anything compared to the standards of the more recent bailouts. But this has been going on for a long, long time, the idea of central banking, fractional reserve banking, allowing banks to overextend themselves, take on way too much risk, and then when they fail, they're bailed out by the hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars by the same government that created the system in the first place that is doomed to do just this, just these things. Rothbard has an interesting discussion here about counterfeiting. And what does counterfeiting do? Is imagine a society that had a commodity standard where people were using gold as their money, and then some big-time, big-league counterfeiters show up. What do they do? What do the counterfeiters do? They start printing up currency that goes into use. Well, they raise prices. If there's no commensurate increase in production, there's going to be price inflation. But another thing that happens with counterfeiting in this imaginary scenario is that the counterfeiters make a lot of money. The people who create the money make a lot of money, but also whoever the money is spent on first makes a lot of money because they get a hold of that money and they get to buy things with that money before inflation happens, before the prices are driven up. This takes time. It might take a year, 18 months or longer for the increase in the money supply to have its full effects, full multiplier effects throughout the economy that drives up all the prices. And so some people will do much better than others under a regime of price inflation caused by counterfeiting. Another thing this does is that if it does raise prices, this is in effect an implicit tax that causes everyone to pay more for the things they buy. And it's a regressive tax, and that lower income people will end up paying a higher proportion of their income in this hidden tax than higher income people will. And also it changes relative prices, because the people who are the first to get their hands on this money will buy different types of things, different types of products than the average middle class person will if they were to get their hands on that money, that increased supply of money in the economy. And so the pattern of relative prices in the economy will be much different than it would be under a free market with a commodity standard. And so there will be a sort of a massive redistribution of income and wealth as a result of this. And this is, by the way, is called the Cantillon effect of monetary growth, named after Richard Cantillon, the French economist. And Rothbard correctly points out that this is essentially an attack on property rights. Because there's a redistribution of income from people whose income is diminished, whose real income is diminished because prices are higher. They no longer have as much purchasing power. But the people who got a hold of the money first, they're actually enriched by it because they got the money and they got to buy things with the money before the prices went up. And of course, Rothbard's example is a mythical example of some society where counterfeiters, quote, are running rampant. But of course, he's implying that this is what happens when we have a central bank. And among the first people always to get the money are the New York investment banks, because they're the ones who buy and sell the bonds for the government. And so the New York bankers and the people all around them are the first, get the first round of the money, and they get access to the profits that they make before the prices have been driven up of goods and services. And so they have a large amount of income redistributed toward them and away from ordinary citizens. And now, Rothbard's discussion of the origins of the Fed is very interesting because he points out the obvious truth that what the bankers, the commercial bankers and the investment bankers always wanted was some sort of government institution that would bail them out when they lost money. They wanted to become gamblers and take on more and more risk and earn the profits from making risky loans and charging high rates of interest in those risky loans. But they wanted to socialize the losses. Now, that should sound familiar to anyone who's paid attention to the bailouts of recent years. And so a central bank was the perfect institution for such a thing. And so the whole purpose of the Fed was to create inflation. Now, Rothbard talks in this big, long article of his about the J.P. Morgan and his banking enterprises and also the Rockefeller empire. Now, the Morgans especially, they were involved in the railroad industry in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and quite a few other businesses. And what was happening all during this era in many industries, railroads, steel, electric power after electricity became commercialized, and many other big industries, was businesses attempted over and over again to cartelize, to form cartels, price-fixing cartels. But as any student of microeconomics knows, cartels always fail from cheating. If they agree to restrict production in order to drive up the price to their preferred monopolistic price, if one member of the cartel cheats by dropping the price or producing more than the agreed amount, he will make a killing, and all the other cartel members will therefore have to follow suit and cut their prices and expand their production too before there is no profit to be made, before the original cheater makes all the profit. And so cartels always break down. And what happened in the railroad industry is just a classic example of what happened in many industries in America in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The railroad companies tried to cartelize, they tried price-fixing cartels. They all failed from cheating. So they needed some sort of super powerful mechanism to enforce the non-cheating, to enforce the cartel. The mechanism they ended up with was the government's Interstate Commerce Commission, created in 1887. Because it's one thing for a private agreement to fix prices to take place. It's another thing to have government police with guns who can enforce such a thing. And you have the government police enforcing such a thing, they'll put some teeth into the enforcement, much more teeth than just private arrangements can have. So the purpose of the Interstate Commerce Commission was to cartelize the railroad industry. And the first head of the ICC was, in fact, the president, the former president of a railroad corporation. And so for decades, they propped up prices of railroads. One of the first things they did was there were complaints that some of the large volume customers of the railroads were being given high volume discounts. You know, some farmer that shipped a million bushels of wheat would be charged a lower price per bushel than a farmer that only shipped 1,000 bushels of wheat on somebody's railroad. Quantity discounts, that's perfectly normal part of doing business in a competitive economy. And so rather than doing anything for the people who were not getting the discounts, the ICC banned all discounts, so it made the high volume shipping interests pay higher prices, but it did nothing for the people who've been complaining about the inequity of some people paying lower rates than they were for railroad shipping. And so it fixed prices and cartelized the industry. The same thing happened in all the so-called public utilities, electricity, natural gas, telephone, eventually cable TV many decades later. They were all cartelized by some government agency. The Civil Aeronautics Board cartelized the airline industry by fixing the rates at monopolistic levels and by essentially banning entry into the industry for 50 years. There were more airlines operating in America in the 1920s rather, than there were in the 1970s. And so the creation of the Fed was all a part of this. It was a part of this progressive era creation of cartels enforced by government. railroad industry, the utilities industry, the airline industry, and quite a few others. The Food and Drug Administration was created for the benefit of the big food and drug companies who wanted to use regulation to crush their smaller competitors. And so it was a slightly different type of cartel arrangement, but it was a cartel arrangement for the benefit of the big food and drug companies. And they're the ones who wanted the Food and Drug Administration to begin with. They didn't oppose it, they wanted it. Just like the bankers wanted a government agency to oversee banking, they wanted it to cartelize banking like it had cartelized other industries that the Morgan family was involved in. And so the Fed was part of this progressive era cartelization movement, and they did find economists who they could pay to dream up rationales for all of this. The government, for example, created franchise monopolies in the so-called public utilities industries, and then after that happened, economists dreamed up the theory of natural monopoly, which says that in industries where there are economies of scale, one large company will eventually take over because it will achieve economies of scale first at a lower cost than anyone else, and will use that to price everybody out of the market and then become a monopoly. Sort of a crude version of the theory of predatory pricing, which has long been one of the sillier myths in economics. And so but that came after the creation of these monopolies. So the monopolies were not creations of the free market. The free market was competitive before these government-sanctioned monopolies came into being. And so a whole body of literature that had myths about free market monopoly was adopted. The natural monopoly myth, the myth about the Sherman Antitrust Act being created in 1890 in the United States to fight off monopolies, that wasn't true either. The industries that were accused of being monopolies in the late 1880s were all cutting prices and expanding output faster than the economy as a whole was at that time. I proved that in a publication of mine called The Origins of Antitrust 29 years ago in the International Review of Law and Economics. And so Rothbard talks, you can read it as well as I can. He named names and talks about the Rockefeller-Harriman-Kuhn-Loeb alliance that worked mightily to create a government-run cartel for bankers, as they had created government-run cartels for railroads, trucking, electricity, and elsewhere. And also there's the House of Morgan. Now, they competed a lot in a lot of areas, the Morgan Empire and the Rockefeller-Harriman Empire. But on the issue of the Fed, they collaborated, or I think conspired would be a more accurate term, to get a national bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital that would enable them to expand the lending, because they were supportive of the National Currency Act of the Lincoln administration. It went a long way to nationalize the currency. The National Currency Act and the Legal Tender Acts of the 1860s, but they didn't centralize it enough in the eyes of the Rockefellers and the Morgans and the Harrimans. And so they wanted a real bank. They wanted a bank run by politicians who would be influenced by them, of course, and their heirs, in order to expand the money supply, create price inflation, create boom and bust cycles, create depressions. But the bottom line was it would enable the banks to lend more money and make more profit, and it would enable them to extend cheaper credit to politically favored corporations like those that were run by the Rockefellers and the Harrimans and the Morgans and the rest. And so this is the story that Rothbard tells in tremendous detail. If you had a chance to read through the article on the case against the Fed, and I'm not going to talk about all those key accounts in the Fed accounting in a short class like this, although Bob Murphy does. If you take his course on the Fed, you can do that. It's very rigorous, and Bob has it all figured out. But I think it always was made to be mysterious and almost impossible for the average person to figure out. It's probably the most confusing thing any economics student ever runs across at the undergraduate level, those key accounts and understanding how the Fed creates money. And I'm pretty sure it was always meant to be that way. It was always meant to be confusing. Thomas Jefferson himself once wrote that he thought that Alexander Hamilton's financial plotting, including the plotting to create a national bank, was intentionally confusing so that the average person would never have any idea what the politicians were up to when they controlled the money supply of the country. And I think Jefferson was right about that, and I think the Fed and its behavior has proved him right about that, because after all, look at all the effort Ron Paul made to try to get an audit of the Fed, and the establishment totally stifled his attempt to do that. So we know very little. And I think that's about what I'm going to say for tonight about the case against the Fed. I guess this whole course has been the case against the Fed, but I wanted to say a few things about Rothbard's article that stresses the myth of the independent Fed, the key word being the myth, and the cartel theory of central banking, which he spends many, many pages on. So we'll do what we usually do. I'll look over the chats and see what kind of chatting is going on, and see if I can answer some of your questions. Cam is doing a great job as usual. I see he has links to the SNL issue, optimal quantity of money, and Cantillon effects. He has my article on the truth about the robber barons. Let's see, Audrey has a question about who was that economist with the natural monopoly theory. It was a number of economists who developed that in the early 20th century. It wasn't any one economist. There were a lot of people who developed this. Yeah, John Stuart Mill had a hand in that. There were some French economists who studied this whole issue of the so-called natural monopolies in the 19th century also. And in France, what is known as competition for the field. In fact, I just happen to have on my desk a book written by a 19th century economist named Edwin Chadwick. I'll see, I'll put it on the board. The author of this book is Robert B. Eklund, and the book is The Economics of Edwin Chadwick. And Eklund has a co-author, Edward O. Price III. And Edwin Chadwick was a 19th century economist. He lived from 1800 to 1809. But he wrote on this, the so-called natural monopoly theory also, and so Bob's book touches upon that, among other things, about the so-called natural monopoly. But on the French economists that I was referring to, they adopted a system of whereby they said, we're not going to do what the Americans eventually did. We're going to have competition. We're going to hold sort of an open bidding for the right to be a monopoly. And so local governments did grant monopoly franchises, but the idea was to have them bid, and whoever bids and offers the lowest price for, say, water supply would get the franchise. But they had to offer a lower price. That way you did have a monopoly, and you did have the benefits of economies of scale, large-scale production and low cost, but you did not have monopoly pricing because they would have a contract with the local town or city in France promising for, say, a three-year contract to charge a certain rate. The rates had to be set in stone, so to speak. But, of course, if you had corrupt politicians who would give a contract to their brother-in-law at monopolistic prices, that's a different story also. But since the question was brought up, I thought I'd mention Chadwick because I just happened to have his book on my desk because I've been asked to review it for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And on the back cover it says, he wrote about a lot of things in the 19th century, and he says, among the things examined are Chadwick's views on government versus market role and dealing with problems created by natural monopoly. And so here's what he looked like, Edwin Chadwick. Okay. And that's not Robert Eklund, that's Edwin Chadwick on there. And so if you want to learn about the origins of natural monopoly, there's a book. I would recommend it. Anything Bob Eklund writes is very scholarly and learned. Let's see, Malcolm has a question here. In a reading or previous lectures, there was a comment that FRB communities, FRB, what's an FRB community? Federal Reserve Board? Well, I'm not sure. You'll have to clarify what an FRB community is, Malcolm. In the meantime, John asks, how do Austrians propose to keep the country unified if the creators of competing currencies move to create new governments based on their currency? Well, Austrian economics has nothing to say about keeping a country unified or whether it's even desirable. I personally don't see any necessarily reason why we have to stick with the existing system. You know, the American Union was always just a practical political arrangement. After the Civil War, it turned out to be held together literally at gunpoint, and it turned out to be a coerced union more along the lines of the Soviet Union than the original American Union, which was a voluntary union. So I think it would be a good thing, myself, if we were to have maybe 10 or 12 or 15 different republics, because democracy can never work in a country of 300 million people. I don't think it could work with in a country as big as 30 million. It becomes unlimited and uncontrollable in a big country like that. And so, and the people, of course, have nothing whatsoever to do with their government in a big country like that. So in my view, it would be a virtue if competing currencies led to a breakup of the American Leviathan state into maybe 15 or 20 or even better yet, 50 different countries. That would give us all an opportunity to have maybe some of these countries based on limited government freedom and prosperity, as opposed to unlimited government, perpetual depression, never-ending warfare, and mind-boggling debt. See if I have another question. Let's see. I meant not the CIA. I mentioned that the Secret Service, which is not the same as the CIA, was created to protect the monetary monopoly. Wasn't the CIA. Where do you find more information? I would recommend going on lourockwell.com and just doing a search. There have been quite a few articles about Bitcoin on Lou Rockwell's website. L-E-W, man's name, rockwell.com. See, Michael asks, how far can they keep inflating? Aren't they creating societies that we can't afford? The answer to that is yes. And I think the problem is politicians are all short-sighted. They all are only interested in the next election and keeping their job in the next election. And so when the stuff hits the fan, when the currency finally crashes, most of the politicians figure that they'll be retired on their fat government pensions or dead, and so they don't really care about the future as much. In fact, on this general question, Hans Hermann Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God That Fails, analyzes decision-making under democracy and compares it to decision-making under a monarchy. And one of the things he talks about is how, at least under a monarchy, if a king owns all the property of a country, he's more inclined to protect the value of that property. Whereas under democracy, it's a sort of a mad rush of everybody to get theirs while the getting is good, in terms of massive rent seeking, the plundering of their neighbors through the tax system. And so democracy has a built-in structure of perpetual plunder and the destruction of the currency, whereas under a monarchy, the monarchs, in most cases, not in every case, but in most cases, have an economic incentive not to do that, not to destroy their own property, because it is theirs. It's their property rights. And so he doesn't come out. He says in the first chapter, he is not a monarchist. He's just using Austrian political and economic theory to analyze the differences in decision-making between democracies and monarchies. But this question about from Michael reminds me of that, and I would recommend that as a source of reading. And Michael says, it seems like there's a currency war and a race to the bottom. Yes, yes, it does. The politicians have all gotten in the act of financing the welfare states by printing money. And now that the welfare states are all imploding, you can only go so far by taxing the productive people in your society and giving money away to the unproductive. And once you get to the state where the unproductive outnumber the productive in votes, it's all over. They will keep voting to raise the taxes more and more on the productive, causing the productive to produce less or to leave the country if they're able. And all they can resort to is printing more and more money, which inevitably will devalue the currency and turn it into nothing. I had at the Austrian Economics Research Conference, I had breakfast one morning with a Bulgarian economist who was telling me that he was complaining that Europeans seem to have no memories of what happened just 20 or 25 years ago, where in countries like Bulgaria, the whole society fell apart in 1 week, and this sort of thing can happen. And but the politicians keep going along doing the same thing they've been doing without seemingly having any apparent knowledge of the tremendous damage that they could inflict on their society. That's called democracy. Let's see, Lucas Roberts asked, a little off the topic, does the Coase theorem adequately explain how free markets can function without government oversight? Well, the Coase theorem is just meant to be a very minor footnote, really, in the situations where there are externalities like pollution, where people could come to voluntary agreements to solve these problems. So it's not a statement about free markets in general. It's a statement about how a certain type of problem in society, smoke from a smokestack, or the sparks, Coase's original example was sparks from a train burning down part of a farmer's wheat field, as an example of a negative externality. And he talks about how the farmers and the railroad companies could somehow negotiate an efficient outcome for both of them and for society as a whole. So it's not really a defense of free markets. It's just an explanation of how this sort of problem can be resolved voluntarily, and they often are. Let's see. Okay, Malcolm is clarifying, from fractional reserve banking communities. Well, that's pretty much every country in the world today. But, if you're asking a question about prosperous communities, you have to control for a lot of other ingredients of prosperity. How well enforced are property rights? How is the rule of law in these different countries enforced? How big is government in general? What is the percentage of the income that is taken in taxes? Is there free trade? Does government control the currency? These are all things. How free are the capital markets? Are they heavily controlled by governments, or are they relatively laissez-faire? So all of these things would have to be controlled for, and it's very difficult to compare countries in terms of prosperity and trying to look at these sorts of things individually. But if you want to learn more about that, I guess there are these indexes of economic freedom that have been published. The Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal published one. And another one is published by the Fraser Institute in Canada. It's F-R-A-S-E-R. And it's called Index of Economic Freedom. Walter Block, the Austrian economist, had a big hand in the creation of these indexes back in the early 1990s. And quite a few other economists, not necessarily Austrians, have worked for years on these indexes of economic freedom. But I think that's what I would look at. They do give a good explanation of sort of the classical liberal view of what constitutes a free society and in terms of economic freedom anyway, and how to measure it. Let's see. Okay, if you want to email, if you want to email, you can feel free to email me or put questions on the website for the course. Let's see, Joe has a question. Is there really a way out of using fiat money here in the U.S.? Yeah, there is. There's a way out of using fiat money. There have been a couple of mainstream articles written in the Wall Street Journal by Judy Shelton about why we need to get back to the gold standard. And I've never met Judy Shelton, but I've read her articles, and she's a very clear writer, and she's taken on the task of trying to explain how we get from here to there. So, and I think she has a book out too. It's called Shelton, Judy Shelton, and so I would recommend looking up her articles on the Wall Street Journal and maybe her book, because I don't think she's an Austrian economist but she seems to have done a nice job of getting into the Wall Street Journal, for one thing, and making the case for a return to a gold standard and addressing the issue of getting from here to there. And so there's no recipe for it. There's no book of Austrian economics where you can look up and say, here's how we do it. People have figured it out for thousands of years, how to adopt the gold standard, and we can do it again, in my opinion. Let's see, there's a question by Rami. Is there research on the rise of new economies and funding sources? I'm not sure what you're referring to, new economics. What this question brings to mind that there's an Austrian economist named Larry White, who published an article, I think it was in the Journal of Monetary Economics, where he surveyed a large sample of American economists who publish in some of the bigger, more prestigious journals that cover monetary issues, and they track down whether or not they've ever received any funding from the Fed, either as employees of the Fed, as contract employees, as summer interns, somebody who wrote a research paper for a couple thousand dollars, something like that. And I think he ended up saying that over 80% of all monetary economists in the U.S. Have been on the payroll of the Fed one way or another. And therefore, of course, he concluded that this is one reason why they are not too eager to criticize the Fed, because they get paid by the Fed. I have not studied the Iranian currency collapse, but I have studied currency collapses, and it's usually a result of printing too much money by the central bank of that country. But I haven't really spent much time studying Iran, I'm sorry. Okay, Malcolm is asking again about foreign currencies. What parties, groups, or individuals? Well, the nationalists, in American political history, the nationalists started with Alexander Hamilton and the Federalist Party. They wanted a national banking system controlled by them. And then after they faded out of the picture, the American Whig Party, W-H-I-G, took up the mantle of the nationalist cause of high protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare for politically connected businesses, and a central bank. And they disappeared in 1852 and were replaced by the Republican Party. And so this was always the nationalist tradition in American political life. And a big part of that nationalist tradition was a national bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital. And of course, owned partly, even if mostly, by private investors. And that's sort of the mercantilistic collaboration of business and government that keeps this system going. Joe read he said that if a country like Libya or Iraq wanted to exchange oil for currency other than the U.S. dollar, they would be attacked. Yes, there's a good. It would be hard to find a smoking gun because our so-called statesmen are very sneaky and secretive. But yes, that's apparent to a lot of people that's likely to happen. There's a bumper sticker that I've seen that says, "Behave yourself, or we will impose democracy on your country." I mean, it's sort of a popular bumper sticker here in the U.S. Among people who understand that behaving yourself means don't rock the boat with regard to the U.S. dollar, and you won't be bombed, or your president won't be assassinated by Hillary Clinton. Let's see. The question about homesteading. On homesteading, there's no substitute. If you want to know what Austrians think about that, read Murray Rothbard on homesteading. His article of his was the title of Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution. I might have mentioned it in the class last week. The first half of it gives a big expose of Murray Rothbard's theory of law and property rights, including homesteading. And he wrote about it in a number of other places. If you look at some of his books of readings, he talks about homesteading. And so in response to that question, that's what I would recommend. I don't know if he gets into these intricate questions about can one person own more than one unconnected homestead. I don't see why not, as far as that goes. Homesteading is homesteading. So there's a link to one of the Judy Shelton articles. The question from Leslie: the income tax and the Fed were instituted about the same time. How did the central bank facilitate collection of an income tax? Well, it doesn't. They were different institutions. It's the Internal Revenue Service collects the income tax. So these were different institutions. Yes, the point is, if we had competing currencies, I suppose, is what she's getting at, it would make it a bit more difficult for the federal government to collect taxes. I don't think it would make it much more difficult because there would just be an exchange ratio of the currencies. Ideally, it would be freely floating currencies, and there would be an exchange ratio determined on the market, just like when you travel in Europe among all the different countries before the euro. There were many different currencies, and they were competing. And the more responsible governments and more responsible banking systems would have stronger currencies than the less responsible ones. But the government could easily translate those into the appropriate exchange ratios. It would take some money, it would cost something, but I don't think it would be a huge burden. Why do other countries keep using and accepting dollars as a reserve currency? I think a lot of it has to do with our military and our foreign policy. The U.S. government, for many generations, has used carrots and sticks to control other governments. They can promise them foreign aid, of all sorts. They can turn the dictators who are our friends into millionaires or billionaires, and they can do the opposite. They can withdraw the money. They can cause problems for them, or they can invade their country and overthrow them. And so the foreign policy apparatus in America has a lot to do with forcing other countries to adopt the dollar as the so-called reserve currency, even though they know we're destroying its value. What is the best book on the early dealing of Robert Morris? Well, read carefully the section of The History of Money and Banking in the United States by Rothbard, and look up his footnotes. This is, it's online, but this is what the actual book looks like, The History of Money and Banking by in the United States. And but look up his footnotes. His footnotes are usually very voluminous, and I could just look up the discussion right here. And of course, the first place I would read was Murray Rothbard's book, Conceived in Liberty. And so get a hold of Conceived in Liberty. Volume 4 of the Revolutionary War has a lot about Robert Morris, and the Mises Institute sells Conceived in Liberty. I'll just read you some of his footnotes. Rothbard says, on the Bank of North America and on Revolutionary War Finance in general, see Curtis P. Nettles, N-E-T-T-E-L-S, The Emergence of a National Economy. And so that's one of the books that Rothbard himself cites. And Robert Morris was a defense contractor. He is known as the financier of the revolution. And so this would be one book. He also cites A. Barton Hepburn, A History of Currency in the United States. And so that's what I would do if I wanted to learn more about Robert Morris. The biographies of people like that often turn into hagiographies. They're sort of hero worship books. You can all, and I usually learn a good bit by reading these biographies, but you have to keep in mind that there's always a spin to them. And so keep in mind that the author, not all the time, but mostly these biographies of characters like this are sort of hero worship books. And if you're just interested in learning the truth about the world, you can still learn a lot from these books. Just take the hero worship with a grain of salt. Okay, what's my view of the Citizens Bank created in North Dakota? I don't know much about it, but it sounds like a good idea to me. The more competition, the better. And there's a link to Conceived in Liberty. And the question of why, as Rothbard said, the British classical liberals never even thought of questioning the Bank of England. Why did they do this? Probably because they weren't that well educated as the others on monetary economics. That would be my sort of guess. I don't know that, but when I think of the British classical liberals, John Locke was a philosopher. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. They weren't monetary economists. They didn't understand these things as well as, say, Murray Rothbard did in later years, or other economists like Turgot in France. And so that would be my guess, although I would have to do some research. That's just off the top of my head. Okay, get back to the chat. And Malcolm is asking again, to what extent did King George prohibit the colonies from issuing legal tender paper? They used British currency. The Americans during the Revolution created the Continental, but they inflated the Continental, the name of the currency, so much that it became valueless. And the slogan, not worth a continental, was popular in America for many decades to come. When something was worthless, it was not worth a continental. And so they didn't really make much of an improvement when they created the continental during the American Revolution. And again, I would recommend, if you're really interested in these questions, reading Conceived in Liberty by Rothbard. Malcolm is wondering if people like Robert Morris were instigating a war so they could set up a bank. I think it's more likely that it was the other way around. They wanted a bank to finance war, and they figured that they could benefit and profit from war, but it would take a bank like that, a national bank run by politicians with the ability to print money to purchase all the things from them that they wanted to sell. And so I think it was probably the other way around. And this is slowly running out of gas here. Is there any country that does not have a central bank? None that I can think of, unless Somalia has been slow to get that. Even after the sort of the revolution in Somalia, what was it, 10 years ago? A lot of the elites in America were very angry because they had not yet set up a central government. And if they didn't have a central government, how could they have a central bank? And so I haven't studied Somalia in recent years, but that would be one guess. If I were to pursue this, that's one place I would look into. Okay, Anton is asking, what's the best source of our topic? How do we protect capitalism from the capitalists? One book on that topic would be The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality by Ludwig von Mises. It's an old book, but it's very, very good, very useful. And there was a book published in the last 5 years or so about that. I can't think of the title. Maybe I'll try to think of it and come up with it next week. But it was not by an Austrian, but it was on sort of capitalism, how capitalists are the enemies of capitalism. I'll think about it. But on the anti-capitalistic mentality is a learned small book. I think it's online at the Mises.org by von Mises. And just also liberalism. I guess liberalism by von Mises explains this pretty well. Or you can read my book, How Capitalism Saved America. And the main purpose of that book was to explain to readers just what capitalism is, and so that they know it is not mercantilism, it is not crony capitalism, it is not bailouts, it is not subsidies, it is not protectionism. That's crony capitalism. In fact, Friedrich Bastiat called all those policies, he said, were socialism. He said socialism, Bastiat said, is not really government ownership of the means of production. It's all these things, minimum wage laws, usury laws, protectionism, subsidies, tariffs, it's all socialism. Now, Cam is doing a great job with the links. Let's see if I can find any other questions here. I don't know how much the Fed janitor makes now. Maybe you can Google that and find out. If they made $163,000 in 1996, I would guess it's over $200,000 now. In fact, I might apply for the job myself. Well, it looks like we're sort of running out of juice here. And with a question about the janitor's salary, so maybe we'll call it a night. I have 6:45, and we all have things to do, I guess. There might be another class somewhere. So thanks again for participating, and next week will be a big week. We're going to talk about central banking and foreign policy interventionism. So So we'll get into some of the good stuff next week, or the bad stuff, depending on your perspective. But that's one of Rothbard's really hallmark articles on the Fed and foreign policy and war. So thanks again to Cam and Catherine and Danny, who did a great job as always.